Good morning, please be seated. Alright, let me see what we got here. First matter on calendar is docket number 62468, Reeves versus Division of Industrial Relations. Mr. Cuvier, are we ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, come on up. Would you like to reserve any time?
I would, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay.
Good morning, Justice Perregaux, Justice Terry, and Justice Douglas. I'm Maximiliano Cuvier. I represent the appellant, Susan Reeves. And for the record, Ms. Reeves and her husband, Jeff Reeves, are presently in the courtroom. As the court has gleaned from not only the extensive record in this appeal, but from other appeals that Ms. Reeves has raised and brought through the Supreme Court, she has diligently pursued her rights under the workers' compensation statutes. There have been several appeals, and this was a matter that was assigned to the Pro Bono Project to help focus the nature of this particular appeal. And so after review of the extensive record and discussion with Ms. Reeves, we have distilled the two central issues on appeal. The first issue is whether she is entitled to a benefit penalty under NRS 616D120, which issue depends on whether her workers' compensation claim was properly terminated, which at the time that we filed the appeal and pursued our briefs was then pending in Supreme Court case appeal number 62981. The second issue that we raised was whether the administrative determinations and process below should be vacated because it was a product of an unfair and unjust process tainted by fraud and prejudice to Ms. Reeves' substantive rights. Now, for the benefit of the court, the first issue we submit has and concede has been decided. What we had requested with particular to the first issue was a stay of the court pending the court's determination in the related case 62981. And on January 15, 2015, this honorable court issued a decision effectively affirming the termination of her workers' compensation claim. And therefore, the issue of whether she's entitled to a benefit penalty under 616D120 has been effectively decided. So what's left is whether the administrative proceedings below should be vacated because they were unfair. Particularly tainted here are two issues. One is Ms. Reeves commenced this process after she was injured. And as you will see from the record, she contacted a doctor after the insurance company requested a certificate of disability. And she contacted Dr. Petrov. And on April 13th, she met with Dr. Petrov. And Dr. Petrov reached the conclusion that it was doubtful that Ms. Reeves could have worked and that she has considerable neck problems that would prevent her from returning to work. Now, the insurance company didn't like that response, and so Ms. Reeves went back to the doctor. A little over a month later, on May 18, 2004, the doctor again concluded that, and I quote, based on objective evidence of her degenerative cervical spine, unquote, Ms. Reeves will not be able to return to gainful employment. And this is at volume 2 at 322 to 323. Again, the insurance company didn't like that either. And so they went to the doctor and met with the doctor just a month later on June 29th. And during this meeting, they booted Ms. Reeves and her lawyer out. And wouldn't you know it, the same doctor suddenly reached a completely different conclusion and recommended that Dr. Reeves undergo a trial back to work. There's no discussion in his opinion about his opposing conclusions that he had reached just a few months earlier in April and then in May. There's no discussion of what circumstances changed and no discussion of objective medical evidence to support his changes in opinion. This opinion, this changed opinion, the insurance company latched onto. And that was a reason to deny her benefits. Now, Ms. Reeves pursued the circumstances here. And through the process, she raised the issue about the change of circumstances. And her main grievance here is that nowhere in the administrative process is there a record that these circumstances were considered by the court and were, and that Ms. Reeves was given a fair opportunity to test the credibility of the doctor's changed opinion, which is the whole basis for her benefits. Now, there is also the issue of Ms. Reeves requested a log of the communications, of all communications, under NRS 616-D330. And a log was produced. But as you see from the record, the log that was produced that evidenced the communication with the doctor demonstrated a couple of considerable changes. One is the entry for the meeting with the doctor of June 29, 2004 was done 2 years after the fact. And the log entry, as the court sees from the record, and the log is at volume 1 at 286. And the log also states that there was a medical staffing meeting with an adjuster supervisor. Dr. Petroff, defense attorney, claimant, and claimant's husband were present. That's what the log says. But if the court in the record demonstrates that Ms. Reeves and her attorney were not present, in fact, they were excluded from the meeting. And this was Dr. Petroff's summary letter. Which is volume 1 at 249. Now,
why was this not raised in the companion case that has been decided?
Your Honor, I don't know how to answer that question. Ms. Reeves at some point had several issues being raised and pursued her appeals pro se. And she raised these issues as they were coming up in different administrative proceedings. This issue was raised below in the administrative proceedings as to the log that did not comply, in essence, with the statute, because the statute requires a contemporaneous keeping of the log that should be produced upon request.
I understand your sub-argument, but the difficulty for us is that it should have properly been raised with the other portion, not as an independent cause. So it puts us in a strange position in trying to really ascertain, because what you are arguing and what you are stating, even though it may be correct as to the actions taken or properly in or proper in the other matter, that's our difficulty. So the question, and I'm asking, how do we get around that to deal with what you're asking us to deal with, or are we stopped?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the court is stopped. I think that the court has the ability to track with the related appeals that were cross-referenced here, that if it does find that the administrative proceedings below were so tainted by this unfairness, that it could vacate them so that we could start that process, and so that it should be consolidated in one process where she can have a counsel that can be assigned to her and help her proceed through the process. At some point, she was represented by Nevada Attorneys for Injured Workers, and then that representation ceased. And for a majority of the litigation below, she has proceeded pro se. And that's the gist of our argument, that the procedure was tainted. We cited a case in our opening brief, which is the Mishler versus State of Nevada Board of Medical Examiners at 109 Nevada 287, which provides that the court may set aside an administrative decision if the agency has prejudiced substantial rights. And we believe in this case, the failure to address these important issues really prejudiced and tainted what should be a fair process, which should be a process that allows the court to consider these evidence. And the record demonstrates that these two important issues were really not considered by the court. The law was accepted on its face value without really determining the underlying issues which were raised. And at this point, unless the court has any questions, I would reserve my time.
Okay. Thanks, Mark. Thank you. Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Jennifer Leonescu. I'm division counsel for the Division of Industrial Relations. I'm going to speak for eight minutes, and counsel for CCMSI will speak for the balance of the time. First, I want to address an error of law made by the appellant in her briefs. As you most likely know, there is no liberal construction of workers' compensation statutes in favor of the claimant. In 1993, the legislature enacted 616A.010, which abrogated the principle of liberal construction in favor of a more neutral analysis.
We understand that, but
yes,
we are always concerned when the issue of fundamental fairness is raised in the context of administrative hearings or any other action, and even more so in the state. Theoretically, this is under state's jurisdiction, so that the state theoretically is overseeing the process. So,
yes and no. That's another fundamental misapprehension by the claimant, that the claimant has carried throughout the proceedings here, and that's what DIR's jurisdiction is. And I'm DIR division. Sorry,
I understand those issues, but when we come down to the issue as was stated factually,
right,
as to a doctor changing their opinion, the attorney for the other party not being privy and escorted out of the room.
Okay.
That is something, just candidly, doesn't sell well above the fold in a newspaper.
Right.
So why don't you start with that and go forward?
Yeah, just that, because what the division's function in a contested claims case is not to step in the shoes of the Department of Administration. We are not the appeals officer. We are not the hearings officer in a case. We cannot step in and say to a TPA or insurer, you need to pay benefits here. Your reopening was wrong. That's not what we are there to do. Those statutes are the privy of the Department of Administration. The DAR's function is to address questions from the public regarding how workers' compensation claims work, and address complaints where the claimant or her attorney requests a benefit penalty because she believes that a statute or regulation was violated. And what happened in this case was 4 to 6 years, 6 years from the date of the conversation that the claimant, that the conversation that the claimant is talking about here, was the first time that the claimant ever came to the division. She contacted DAR in February of 2010 to, quote, help me get the actual oral communications, the written record of what was said, by whom, and to whom at the meetings with my doctors. That's the letter. The appellant, as you can tell, admitted that she was present initially at that meeting, knew who was present at the meeting, and received the log. What she did not agree with was the contents of the log. At that time, she did not request a benefit penalty. This was merely a request for assistance. Now, to be sure, DAR cannot possibly investigate every request for assistance in a claim as a request for benefit penalty. That's our authority. We have to determine which complaints give rise to a benefit penalty and which do not. And in this case, when we reviewed the file, we looked at the file, we determined that she received everything that was there. Everything that was in the file, we believed that she had received. In fact, she turned pretty much the entire claims file over to you. And this argument that there was a clandestine meeting between her doctors and the adjusters does it make it a violation of the statute? NRS 6160.330 allows for conversations to take place between an adjuster and a medical provider, as long as it's documented.
And that, I guess, is the point of contention from both sides.
I understand.
The one position that entering in the log that a meeting was held is sufficient, versus the other side saying, well, that is not sufficient because there's no details.
And I understand and I understand that that's what her argument is, but her argument is more that this argument happened and tainted the entire process.
I understand that.
Yeah.
Your position in terms of the sufficiency of the log.
The sufficiency of the log, when we looked at it, we believe that it contained the contents. Now, we cannot determine whether it was correct, whether it was there. We can only determine whether it meets the requirements of the statute.
I thought the determination was whether or not it was an intentional failure to maintain the log, and whatever was in the log is kind of a factual issue.
Right.
And so the real question is whether or not the failure to maintain the claimed failure to maintain the log was intentional. That was my question.
Well, there was two issues. One was there was no appeal rights attached to the termination. The second issue we brought up below, and just to be noted, the claimant was represented throughout the underlying litigation by both private counsel and NAIW. So she may have handled her appeals pro se, but she definitely had counsel during the claims process, during the reopening, during the TTD requests, all of that. As far as the log itself, when we issue a letter on a request for assistance like this one, we don't address if there was an intentional violation because we found that the information was sufficient. After that, there's also NRS 616D330 has its own penalty scheme, and the first violation of the log is a minor violation. A second violation is a $250 fine, and a third or subsequent violation is a $1,000 fine. So then there's also the issue that this happened 6 years before we came up, and I argued the statute of limitations issues as well. As you know, under 11.190, there's a 2-year statute of limitations for a statute that creates a penalty or forfeiture. In this case, the statute of limitations should apply because the facts of this conversation happened 6 years earlier. The log was created 6 years earlier. The time for her to bring this up, if she believed that it tainted her entire claims history, was back then.
Well, let me ask you this. The appeals officer essentially found that there was no benefit penalty to be awarded, substantial evidence, the district court found substantial evidence supported that particular determination based upon the fact that there was no unreasonable delay.
Correct, that there was no unreasonable delay, but in our motion, or dispositive motion, I did address the log issue by both the jurisdictional issue and the statute of limitations issue. So I think that determination that she also said that there was no evidence to support, there's no violation to support any violation of NRS 616.120, and that to me would include an intentional violation. Could it have been clearer? Of course it could have been clearer. But to state that 6 years afterward that the TPA should come back and try to address all of what the claimant appellant perceived to be wrongs, that's not DIR's burden here. That's not DIR's authority. We just can't do that, and we can't order benefits to be paid.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Yield the rest of my time.
All right. Mr. Hooks.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Dalton Hooks on behalf of CCMSI, as well as a self-insured employer in this matter. I outlined my statements based on the synopsis that the Court provided, and counsel for the claimant has conceded that with respect to the first question, Number one, this body, this honorable body, has decided that case. And so in terms of whether there is, whether the appeals officer's determination that Ms. Reeves would not be entitled to a benefit penalty, given that she was not found to be entitled to axiomatically so. So then turning to the synopsis that the court provided, did the appeals officer err when finding that the oral, the deficiency in the oral communications log, and also CCMSI's refusal to supply a certificate of form to Ms. Reeves? I want to address that second question first, because this represents a misapprehension. There are several in this case in terms of what the certificate of disability is. The certificate of disability comes from NRS 616C475 sub 7, and it is that document which is produced by the treating physician.
We're talking the D39 form?
The D39 form is, I believe, slightly different. What this essentially is, Justice Douglas, is the doctor saying, look, this injured worker is not able to perform at her full capabilities. Here are the restrictions that I'm giving her, and therefore she's unable to work. It's not provided to the doctor by DIR or my client or anyone else. It's produced by the doctor. And what effectively the litigation that proceeded along the other lines was with regard to that question. At the heart of that, Ms. Reeves' concern, belief, is that because of the meeting that she alleges she was excluded from, and we'll submit to you, there was no evidentiary hearing regarding this, and so those facts are somewhat at dispute. But I think, Justice Douglas, you've hit on the salient issue, and that is, when should that have been raised with respect to this matter? There are two spheres in which these claims operate, and Ms. Leonescu touched on that. The first sphere is contested claims, which is the actual provisions of benefits, the things that the claimant asserts that she's aggrieved by. I didn't get TTD benefits. I wanted more treatment. I wanted the scope of my claim expanded. Those are all addressed under chapters NRS 616C295 through 392, and the agency that oversees those disputes is the Department of Administration.
The counsel for Ms. Reeves has asserted basically that we should, in essence, roll this back and have this claim and the claim that theoretically has already been decided heard together. That would be more appropriate. What is your position on that?
Yes.
And are they barred as to splitting the claims?
Your Honor, yes. We believe that effectively that ship has sailed. I don't know that I want to use the term barred, but Your Honor, this body has already issued a determination with respect to whether the claimant is entitled to additional benefits. And what I find instructive in this regard is looking at the legislative history for NRS 616D330, the provision about the log. What was the legislature trying to accomplish? And the very concern that Your Honor raised about whether this is something that looks right in the public eye was the discussion that the legislature had about that. The purpose of the log is not to prevent oral communication between any of the parties involved in the claim, the insurer, the TPA, or anyone else. It is to make sure that there is some record so that if there is a belief on behalf of an injured worker or their counsel that something untoward happened, and you'll find in the legislative history that that is was not even considered by the proponents of the bill, which was from 1997, AB 147, was not contemplated. What they were trying to do is to make sure that there was transparency.
Well, then that...
And here, I'm sorry.
That is your rendition of the history raises kind of a problem, because that's kind of their argument, that there was a log, but there's nothing basically in the log except that a meeting was held. So how does it create that transparency that you were alluding to? it would seem to be deficient as to that primary issue.
In this case, Your Honor, to the extent that there was a meeting, per the records that we have before us, Ms. Reeves was there. To the extent that what she asserts is that the problem lies in the fruit of the poisonous tree, that somehow there was either undue influence, and actually the briefing suggests that there was out-and-out fraud, which we take accession to, but that the doctor flipped his opinion. The claimant had a number of remedies to address that. She was aware of the conversation when it happened back on June 29th, 2004. As was noted in that legislative history, the claimant has a litany of remedies existent to deal with this problem. The first is, if she believed every determination that's issued by the insurer of consequence is appealable. She's got 70 days to appeal it, and it goes through the administrative process, a hearing, and an appeal, which is the case on, there are, I believe, six matters for Mrs. Reeves that have been up to this body. All of them have been decided except for this one. And so with respect to that scenario, let's put it in a light most favorable to the claimant. Someone went in and had Dr. Petroff flip his opinion. She could have deposed Dr. Petroff. She could have gotten another doctor to say that Dr. Petroff was wrong and had to be the product of some sort of fraud because clearly her medical records support otherwise. That was all litigated in the other matters.
Well, and that's what I'm trying to figure out. In January of 2015, this court, I thought, resolved all these issues, or a lot of those issues were parcel of that appeal, weren't they?
I believe that's correct. My time has expired, Your Honor.
That's all right. I mean, I don't know.
Answer your question. Sit down again.
I don't want
to.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're just fine. You're just fine.
All of those issues have been resolved, and in fact, the time and place for the claimant to raise those issues was in that substantive hearing concerning benefits, because that's
what I'm trying to understand, because the claim was closed for all purposes in January of 2015, from what I understand.
The claim was actually closed before that, Your Honor, and then there was a petition for reopening, which worked all the way up, and the petition for reopening was denied by the district court and ultimately, I believe, in 2003, affirmed by this court. So to suggest, and there are several issues with the question, Ms. Reeves was in the room when she was excluded. The record will demonstrate that the third-party administrator has changed three times since then. We would not be able to produce anyone who was in the room who could say what happened. And this is why the statute of limitations has to put some sort of finality with respect to the claimant seeking redress of these.
Many of the issues that are being claimed now are factual issues in that case. We have to find clear error and that it was an abuse of the agency's discretion to overturn that.
Yes, Your Honor, I would concur with that assessment.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right, Mr. Cavalier, you've got, I think, almost 5 minutes left.
Thank you very much. First, I want to distinguish, we're not here in contravention of NRS 616A. We're not asking for the court to tip the construction of one statute in favor of Ms. Reeves. What we're asking here is for a determination and looking at a fair and overall process. In Nasiri versus Chiropractors Physicians Board, which we cited in our opening brief, which is at 130 Nevada Advance Opinion 27, this court determined that administrative proceedings, while they not typically follow the rules of evidence, they should amount and ensure a fair and impartial hearing.
I thought that was a very fine decision written by this court.
I did too, Your Honor. In Morgan versus the U.S., this is a 58 Supreme Court 773. Again, the Supreme Court also echoed the same sentiment, and it stated, in administrative proceedings are quasi-judicial character of the liberty and property of the citizens shall be protected by the rudimentary requirements of fair play. In fact, what really happened here is that NRS 616D 330 was applied favorably to the insurance company. They produced a log after the fact. The log was on its face, False. It had the entry done after the fact. It stated that the Ms. Reeves was present with her lawyer, but in fact, the doctor's letter, and this is the letter which the insurance company relied on, which is volume 1 at 249, doctor's letter said that Ms. Reeves and her counsel were excluded.
Counsel, this is not, I guess part of the issue for us is that this is not a new issue. And borrowing from the criminal law, this is not a newly discovered item. Ms. Reeves was there, her then counsel of record was there, and it appears it was not litigated in the primary case. So the question I asked before is still a valid question is, why should we entertain that now when it should have been part and parcel of the basic claim?
Well, Justices, what I would submit is part of the program, part of the reason that I'm here is to assist pro se litigants.
I understand.
And in this case, I believe that there was a wrong to be righted. And the fact that Ms. Reeves pursued that appeal, the separate appeal, to its conclusion, she did so pro se. She, for whatever reason, raised the issues that she raised there and then pursued this separate appeal in which the court determined that it was probably helpful for her to have pro bono counsel. After looking at the record, we made those determinations and found that there was substantial prejudice to her. And I think that the court has this equitable powers to right the wrong. And that is what Ms. Reese is seeking from the court. It's also notable that we start with the Department of Industrial Relations when they say, well, we looked at this. But if you look at in their opposing brief, they relied on the evidence that contradicts itself. They said, well, the doctor said that she wasn't disabled. But the same doctor's opinion also called into question the nature of the meeting. She was excluded. Her attorney were excluded. Then the Department of Industrial Relations said, well, they also produced the log. But the log says that she was present, and so was her counsel. So it just goes to show that at every level, these things were just taken at face value without considering the concerns that were raised by her, which was not that the ex-party meeting had taken place. What happened as a result of that ex-party meeting, and why wasn't that addressed in the administrative determinations? And the log, the statute says you have to produce a log. The statute, I believe, contemplates it has to be contemporaneous. Why? Because of transparency and because of accuracy. Here, that entry was done years after the fact when they said, oh, she wants a log, write it in and produce it.
So do you disagree with the aspect that, or the reading of the rule that the log or that the agency must intentionally not provide the log?
I think that the log has to be maintained contemporaneously. That is when there's communication. My time is up, and I will answer the question.
Right, but that's I'm going to the aspect of whether or not the DIR had to find that the CCMSI intentionally failed to provide that log, and they didn't. And isn't that a factual determination that they make?
Well, it's part of their obligation to ensure a fair process, and that is if the log was produced and the log itself calls into question the validity of it, you have what the record suggests or demonstrates was an attempt to, after the fact, try to comply with the statute falsely.
Okay, I'm just trying to square that with 616D120. And that's where I'm just struggling a little.
And we believe that there wasn't compliance. I mean, the DIR, when...
So are you arguing that they intentionally failed to provide the log, contrary to what the...
They did not. I'm arguing, yes, that they intentionally did not comply with the log, and it was, and when they attempted to do so, it was done with the circumstances that call into question that validity of the log.
Okay. All right, counsel, thank you. We appreciate the good briefs on this and the argument today, and this matter will stand submitted.
Thank you.